This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Jim Bertel. President-elect Joe Biden today announced key appointments for his economic team.
Today, I have the pleasure, of announcing key and appointments for the critical economic positions in the administration. A first-rate team that's going to get us through this ongoing economic crisis and help us build the economy back, not just build it back, but build it back better than it was before.
The president-elect nominated Janet Yellen to the position of Secretary of the Treasury, an appointment that has already achieved much bipartisan praise. She will be the first woman in American history to hold that position. His second announced election was Neera Tanden as director of the government's Office of Management and Budget. If confirmed by the Senate, Tanden would be the first woman of color and first South Asian American to head the agency. Meanwhile, U.S. President Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the election results were dealt another blow. The nation's top law enforcement official says there's no fraud to be found that would change the president election. AP's Shelley Adler reports.
Attorney General William Barr says the Justice Department has not uncovered evidence of widespread voter fraud that would change the outcome of the 2020 election. His comments in an interview with the Associated Press come despite President Trump's repeated claims that the election was stolen. Barr said U.S. attorneys and FBI agents have been working to follow up specific complaints and information they've received, but told the AP, quote, to date, we have not seen that could have affected a different outcome in the election. Shelley Adler, Washington.
Some establishment Republicans are sounding alarms that President Donald Trump's denial of his own defeat could threaten the party's ability to win a Senate majority and counter President-elect Joe Biden's administration. From Washington, via remote, you're listening to VOA News. A bill requiring Iran's government to suspend nuclear inspections unless sanctions are lifted was passed by the hardline-led parliament on Tuesday. Reuters' Adam Reed has more.
Iran's parliament passed a bill on Tuesday that would suspend inspections and other constraints on its nuclear program agreed with world powers unless international sanctions are lifted. It appears to be a further response to the assassination of one of its top nuclear scientists last week. It also calls for Iran to enrich uranium, quote, for peaceful uses in what would be a breach of the nuclear accord. But the bill still needs the local body to become law, and the government promptly said that the move by parliament could not change Iran's nuclear policy, which was the province of the Supreme National Security Council.
That's Reuters' Adam Reed reporting. The United States on Tuesday sharply criticized China for not enforcing sanctions on North Korea and vowed to step up its own efforts as hopes fade for a last-minute breakthrough under outgoing President Trump. Alex Wong, the U.S. Deputy Special Representative on North Korea, says Pyongyang has not yet taken any concrete steps towards denuclearization. The European Union said Tuesday it could be vaccinating citizens against COVID-19 by the end of the month if medical officials grant emergency approval of two vaccine candidates. This comes as the German pharmaceutical company BioNTech and its American partner Pfizer say they have submitted an application for conditional approval of their coronavirus vaccine with the European Medicines Agency. AP's Charles de Ledesma reports.
The two companies say the submission, which occurred Monday, completes the rolling review process they initiated with the Europe Agency on October 6th. The move comes a day after rival Moderna said it was asking US and European regulators to allow emergency use of their COVID-19 vaccine. BioNTech says if the vaccine is approved, its use in Europe could begin before the end of 2020. Last month, that clinical trials showed the vaccine had an efficacy rate of 95%. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
In the U.S., the country looks forward to massive vaccinations for COVID-19 to get underway soon. Multiple regions in the U.S. are reporting that hospitals are filled to capacity with COVID patients. Today is World AIDS Day, with organizations around the world highlighting the need to support those living with and affected by HIV, the virus that causes the disease, while also remembering those who have died. This year's event comes amid the global coronavirus pandemic, which the UN says has made it more difficult for those living with HIV to access health care. For more on any of today's news, please go to voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America and James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ugandan police Tuesday fired rubber bullets at opposition supporters as Bobi Wine campaigns.
I don't know why it appears as if we are in a war zone, for heaven's sake. I don't know why Museveni is extremely scared of Ugandans, that now he has realized they want him to go, and so he decides, okay, I'm going to kill all of you.
UNHCR seeks urgent access to Eritrean refugees trapped in Ethiopia's Tigray region. Nigeria is ranked the third most terrorized nation. HIV innovation continues in Africa amid dual pandemics. Fears grow of further COVID-19 spikes ahead of Ghana's election. And Tanzania's opposition petitions the African Court on Human and People's Rights.
Under the African Charter on Human and People's Rights, everybody has the right to participate in the government of his or her country. So we want the African Court to tell us what are the minimum conditions that is accepted in a country to have free, fair, and transparent elections.
And today is the International Day to Abolish Slavery. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Police in Uganda fired tear gas and rubber bullets at opposition leader Bobi Wine on Tuesday as he campaigned ahead of the January 14 presidential election. Bobi Wine says police injured his music producer and a bodyguard who were rushed to a hospital. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
It was all chants and excitement for supporters of National Unity Platform leader Robert Kyagulanyi, better known as Bobi Wine, as he arrived in Kayunga District in eastern Uganda. But as more people gathered, security officers started shooting both live and rubber bullets into the air, as well as tear gas to break up the crowds. Videos posted online show Wine standing on top of his car, then getting down to confront police. As he asked the officers why they are trying to kill his supporters, a shot is heard and Wine falls down. Wine escapes, but his producer, Dan Magic, is hit in the mouth by a rubber bullet. One of Wine's security guards, identified as Kato, is also struck. In a special address on Sunday, President Yoweri Museveni, who seeks to extend his 34-year hold on power, warned that Wine and other opposition figures should not think they are untouchable. Joel Senyonyi, the spokesperson for the National Unity Platform, says the speech was a command to security forces to use violence against the opposition.
Look, I don't know why it appears as if we are in a war zone, for heaven's sake. I don't know why Museveni is extremely scared of Ugandans, that now he has realized they want him to go, and so he decides, okay, I'm going to kill all of you.
Paul Bukenya, the Electoral Commission spokesperson, says the panel has continuously condemned violence in the electoral process.
We do not want to see violence because violence does another place in the electoral process. We're looking at having well-organized meetings that are also mindful of COVID-19. But we've also reached out to police to ensure that how does policing this election or this campaign would be, and outlined the importance of enforcing the guidelines in a manner that still facilitates candidates to access places where they're supposed to hold their meetings.
On Monday, police said they were investigating an accident involving a motorcycle that had been carrying Wine supporters and a police truck that was following them. Three people were killed. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
In Tanzania, the opposition ACT Wazalendo political party has taken President John Magufuli's government to the African Court on Human and People's Rights for violating the rights of the opposition during the October 28 contentious presidential election. The suit says the government, the National Electoral Commission, police, the army, and the Tanzanian Broadcasting Corporation all combined to violate the rights of opposition candidates to freely participate in the election. Senegalese human rights activist Ibrahim Akan is one of the lawyers representing the opposition ACT Wazalendo party. He says the opposition wants the court to outline minimal conditions for a free and fair election in Africa because under the African Charter on Human and People's Rights, everyone has the right to participate in choosing the government of his or her country.
You know, Tanzania is certainly the only country in Africa, maybe in the world, where When you participate in an election, after the election, if you are not satisfied with the result of the election, you have nowhere to go. There is no possibility for a Tanzanian to go to court in Tanzania and to contest presidential election. And we found that really terrible for a country that is seen as a leader in terms of dispensation of democracy and so and so. So that's the reason we supported one of the candidates to go to the African court and to get from the court a decision saying that in any election in Africa, the person who has lost the election has the right to go to court and to give the court the information, the evidence that allow him or her to say that maybe she has won the election or she doesn't accept the result of the election. In addition to that, this particular election took place in a very, very peculiar context. There was an attack on civil society organizations, an attack on bloggers, an attack on any person who just wanted to participate in the conversation around the election.
So what do you want overall to come out of this case? I mean, what are you demanding?
We are demanding to the court to really say how elections should be organized and what are the rights that are enshrined in the charter and that can be used for somebody who has lost the election and think that the election were not organized properly and who think that also the way the election were conducted were not free and fair. Because under the African Charter on Human and People's Rights, everybody has the right to participate in the government of his or her country. So we want the African court to tell us what are the conditions, the minimum condition that is accepted in a country to have free, fair and transparent election.
You're saying the court should direct the Tanzanian government to investigate and bring to account all persons found to be responsible for violating the rights of the opposition. Is this realistic? Because, as you know, the court is based in Tanzania. And besides, African governments have a very poor record of respecting the decisions of regional courts.
Well, that's true. I agree with you. But, when you do this kind of litigation, in our language as a lawyer, we call it strategic litigation. These are the kind of cases when you take them before this regional court. And when a good decision is taken, it's for the whole continent. It's not only for Tanzania. It's for the whole continent. If a decision is taken that free and fair election include the possibility of any person who participated in election to go to court, to national court, and to contest those elections, it's a victory for democracy on the continent.
Ibrahim Akan is a Senegalese human rights activist and one of the lawyers representing the opposition. You're speaking with us from Dakar. The UN Refugee Agency is appealing to Ethiopian federal authorities for access to camps housing thousands of Eritrean refugees who have been without humanitarian aid since the start of the conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region early last month. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Food was last distributed to some 96,000 Eritrean refugees sheltering in four camps before the Ethiopian government began its military assault on Tigray November 4th. The UN Refugee Agency says by now the camps have run out of food supplies, making hunger and malnutrition a real danger. It also expresses concern about the safety and security of the refugees, many of whom are likely to be in the line of fire. UNHCR spokesman Barbara Baluch says it is not possible to verify what is happening because all communications in Tigray have been cut off. But he says there are reports that some refugees may have fled the camps and are now internally displaced inside the northern Ethiopian region.
And other refugees who are in the camps, they may start moving away as well. But in terms of attacks, abductions, forced recruitments, these are all worrying reports that have reached us. Till the time we don't get access, it's very hard to verify.
Baluch says it is critical that humanitarians be allowed to reach and help these people in desperate need. In the meantime, the UNHCR reports Ethiopians continue to flee to Sudan in search of refuge. It says nearly 46,000 now have arrived, Baluch, however, notes the numbers arriving on a daily basis now have decreased from thousands to hundreds.
Those refugees who are arriving now, they do mention seeing more checkpoints on the roads which connect Ethiopia to Sudan. So they mentioned their difficulty in terms of moving around, so they have to take other ways to reach Sudan.
The UNHCR says people in search of safety and assistance should not be prevented from doing so either within their country or across international borders. The agency is appealing for $147 million to provide humanitarian aid for up to 100,000 refugees for the next 6 months. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Wednesday, December 2nd. A pandemic atop another pandemic makes for a strange, unsettling celebration of World AIDS Day. But even amid worries about coronavirus, health workers and community activists in the country with the world's highest HIV burden, South Africa, are finding innovative ways to fight the spread of HIV. VOA's Anita Powell in Johannesburg looks at one such pilot project started right before the global pandemic struck that has had remarkable results.
Tabani Raymond Kalala, or Coach, as he prefers to be called, was diagnosed with HIV 6 years ago. He lives in a small town in rural South Africa. But when societies across the globe went into viral lockdowns, his world expanded. This year, the 33-year-old community development worker was part of a pilot project called Coach Mpilo. The word means life or health in isiZulu. As a coach, he works with 54 newly diagnosed men and boys, supporting their HIV journey and boosting them in ways big and small. The launch of the project earlier this year coincided with the beginning of global shutdowns to stop the spread of the coronavirus. But he says that hasn't slowed down progress.
I think the program has been successful. However, the challenge is we had to cut down many coaches. We need to try, I'm not sure if this is possible, but if we can get more coaches, because the program has been very successful to such an extent that even the facilities that we work in have seen the difference that we've been doing.
This small initiative is one of the ways that the nation with the world's heaviest burden of HIV continues to innovate. The coaching program will soon be fully funded for about $1 million a year from the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, which has totaled $90 billion so far since launching in 2003. Those funds for the coaching program, which cover about 4,000 players and 50-plus coaches across South Africa, go a long way. Organizers say the results have been astonishing in terms of getting participants to stay on their medications. Today's HIV drugs can beat the virus down to undetectable levels in the blood, meaning it cannot be transmitted. Project organizer Silver Shabalala.
I think this has been like a revolutionary program for us because it has never happened before, you know, where HIV positive men come together and support each other in a way that is very sincere and, you know, honest, and which has got like a brotherhood, you know, kind of, you know, relationship. We've seen that, I mean, the retention rate for coaching below in the 6 months that we piloted the project, it was a 98% retention. We retained almost 4,000 men that, you know, had been lost, you know, to treatment. And if you look at DOH, I mean, their retention is almost like 24% during COVID. So this was really something that was amazing in terms of the retention rate.
On Tuesday, Dr. Deborah Birx, the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator and U.S. Special Representative for Global Health Diplomacy, said the dual pandemic has still allowed for progress. The U.S.-funded effort means almost 3 million babies have been born HIV-free. More than 20 million lives have been saved, and the number of people in treatment has increased. But Birx says doctors cannot do this alone. That's why they need community partners.
In some cases and in some countries, we're actually seeing more stigma and more discrimination among key populations. This is not getting better. If anything, the structural barriers that exist now are getting higher and more difficult to address. And that's why we have to put effort not only into setting up these peer-led services, but protecting those peer-led services so that they can be successful.
Coach Kalala has one message for the world during this very strange time.
People shouldn't feel sorry for us. We're just ordinary human beings like every other person who takes TB treatment, who takes BP treatment, you know. I think support is very important. Do not stigmatize.
It's precisely the kind of thing a coach would say. Words that resonate well beyond his tiny coastal town of Tuolumne, and well beyond one pandemic, or even two. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Ghana has been lauded for its COVID-19 response and a fairly low death toll of 323 people. Total cases have now surpassed 50,000. However, experts fear that cases will increase as political parties go into full campaign mode ahead of the December 7th vote. Stacey Nutt reports from Accra.
Ghana's health service recently estimated that more than 80% of Ghanaians are not wearing face masks, a drastic drop from previous compliance levels. Last month, President Nana Akufo-Addo urged Ghanaians to put on the masks during rallies for the December 7 election. But at campaign events across the nation for both Akufo-Addo's New Patriotic Party and the opposition National Democratic Congress, supporters are flouting the rules. As she waited for the president to show up for an outdoor campaign event in Accra, Cynthia Asiema said it was frustrating to see other supporters without their masks.
Some people are not wearing their nose masks, but they don't listen to their... Yeah, seriously. They don't listen to their president because president talks that everybody must wear the nose masks first.
Some political organisers are taking precautions, holding events outdoors or online. Some hold health walks instead of traditional rallies. Public health expert Nana Kofi Kwakye says it was wishful thinking, though, to believe the large outdoor gatherings would not increase risks, especially given the low compliance to social distancing and mask wearing.
Yes, they're outdoors, so they're less risky than they would be if they were indoors, but that doesn't mean they're safe. And by virtue of that fact, by virtue of the fact that it's not a zero-risk scenario, the more of those that happen with more acute conditions around mask wearing, distancing, and ventilation, we would expect to see some marginal contribution to the infection rates.
Kwakye says the false belief that COVID-19 usually doesn't have a major impact on health has led some Ghanaians to take more risks. Ghanaian sports journalist Gary Ulsmith is trying to spread the word that for many who survive the virus, there can be long-term effects. He was infected with COVID-19 while reporting on it and documented his recovery.
If your inclination is that you have COVID for 14, 21 days, and after that you'll be fine, but you get to know the realities, as in my case, I had headaches constantly for 2 months. I could not take 10-minute walks because after 5 minutes, I was completely blown away. I was completely finished.
He says he often feels like a broken record when he speaks about COVID-19, finding a widespread lack of interest in hearing about the virus now, especially as the election has taken centre stage. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
A new report by the Institute for Economics and Peace ranks Nigeria the third most terrorized nation in the world following persistent attacks by the Boko Haram terror group. According to the report, deaths attributed to attacks by the terror group increased by 23% from 2018 to 2019. It says the terror group remains a regional threat to countries such as Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. Segun Bularinwa, head of security and strategic studies at the Nigeria Institute of International Affairs, tells viewers Chinedu Ofor that contrary to the report, attacks by terrorist groups are on the decline.
The truth is that it worsens the economic condition of the poor people and the middle-income earners because Nigerian economy is not economy that production drives. There are no functional industries. Most of the goods are imported from outside of the country. So a situation where you have a high exchange rate to the Naira automatically means that it's going to be difficult for the ordinary people to be able to afford the goods that have been produced and shipped into this country.
What are some of the social effects that you think this devaluation might bring?
It will be increased poverty, and it will mean that more of the few industries that are left are going to have to collapse. That would mean more people going into the unemployment market, and that means that even drugs, most of which are imported into this country, will not be affordable to the ordinary people.
the devaluation.
It shows how insensitive the government is, because this is the only country in the world that increases the price of petroleum products at the peak of the coronavirus lockdown. This is the only country in the world that increases electricity tariff at the peak of the lockdown. And this time around, devaluing the currency at a time you're not producing anything, that shows the government is so insensitive, and that shows that the government does not care about the ordinary people.
That was Segun Bolarinwa, head of security and strategic studies at the Nigeria Institute of International Affairs. He spoke with viewers Chinedu Ofowo from Lagos. At least 40 million people worldwide are victims of modern slavery, according to the International Labour Organization, the ILO. The group says even though modern slavery is not defined in law, it is used as an umbrella term to cover up practices such as forced labour, debt bondage, forced marriage, and human trafficking. Kenya is among countries where men, women, and children are trafficked for the purposes of forced labor and sexual exploitation. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, USA.
As the world marks International Day of Abolition of Slavery, this year's theme is Confronting Slavery's Legacy of Racism Together. In most African countries, modern slavery is still being experienced within the continent and abroad. Most of these situations are exploitation that a person cannot refuse or leave because of threats, violence, deception, and abuse of power. Some Kenyans who have worked in the Middle East as house helps have experienced modern slavery firsthand. Valerie Vugutha is a Kenyan who ran away from a hostile employer in Saudi Arabia. Apart from her working as a domestic worker, she was also exposed to rape and sexual harassment from the family she worked for.
Working in Arab countries is a little bit hard for someone who has never worked in Gulf countries. Men there, they take advantage of you. As for me, I was a victim of rape 3 times, and the son of the house was always on my toes in the morning, to an extent of raping me, beating me up.
Valerie says his employer could breach the contract and pay her less as they wish, and nothing could be done about it. She terminated her contract and ran back home amid the COVID-19 crisis.
As for me, it wasn't my wish not to complete the contract, but the things I went through were not okay for me. Eating is a problem. Sleeping is a problem.
On the contract, it was written I was supposed to be paid 900 Saudi riyal. So when I reached the house, I was given 850.
Okale Makanda is a Kenyan labor and employment lawyer. He says most of the Kenyans working outside the country are subjected to slavery because most of them are not registered with labor unions to protect them against hostile employer, since most of them leave the country because of poverty to become domestic workers.
There is a challenge even in Kenya regarding treatment of especially domestic employees, and there have been cases even of torture locally. The challenge has always been that because of levels of education, obviously, a lot of poverty, there's been a lot of challenges of Africans, especially from East Africa, claiming that they've been working in the Middle East under servitude as domestic servants, and most of these employees are not registered with the national bureaus in Kenya, for instance, or in East Africa before they locate those countries.
Okale, however, says that the modern slavery is still worse and it might take longer to abolish it.
The situation is still very dire. Despite the efforts that have been made by the global world to try and manage this, human trafficking is on the rise, both either voluntarily or forced.
According to the International Labour Organization, more than 150 million children are subject to child labor, accounting for almost 1 in 10 children around the world. In Africa, children are trafficked within the continent for domestic servitude, forced labor in agriculture, and for commercial sexual exploitation, including involvement in sex tourism industry. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
And that's it for this Wednesday, December 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a good day.